Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowestpriceguarantee.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Value Inspiration Podcast. My name is Ton Dobber and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration. The purpose of my company is to help business software companies rethink what can be to become remarkable again. The goal that I have with this podcast is to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. So my strong belief is that we can think big, and therefore we should. And doing so will help to create a better world for all of us. And this podcast is all about that. The guest on my podcast this week is Brett Frischmann, author of Reengineering Humanity.
Humans have always developed tools and technologies, and they often augment who we are or enable us to grow, develop, pursue our passions, and develop capabilities. The big idea is that we're on a slippery slope path toward a world in which more and more of our lives, of who we are and who we can be as individuals and collectively, is managed and governed by supposedly smart techno-social system. The idea that one of the most important constitutional questions, in a lowercase c sense, for us to be considering in the 21st century is, how are we going to sustain our freedom to be off, to be free from the engineered influence of others? We're building the world for our children, for future generations, and sometimes we don't stop to think about whether we're happy about the world we're building, why we're building it a certain way as opposed to another way.
This is Brett. Brett is the author of Reengineering Humanity and the Charles Witcher Endowed University Professor in Law, Business and Economics at Villanova University. In this role, he promotes cross-campus research, programming and collaboration. He fosters high visibility academic pursuits at the national and international levels and positions Villanova as a thought leader and innovator at the intersection of law, business and economics. Brett's work has appeared in leading scholar publications, including Columbia Law Review, Journal of Institutional Economics, and the Review of Law and Economics. And his research spans across various disciplines and topics: infrastructure, knowledge commons, and the techno-social engineering of humans, i.e. the relationships between the techno-social world and humanity. This is what the scope of his latest book, Reengineering Humanity, is all about. And that triggered me. Hence I invited Brett to my podcast. We explore the evolving impact of technology, and in particular the impact it has on all of us in our day-to-day professional life. We discuss examples of how we engineer ourselves and how we are engineered by others. In particular, the latter has become a big risk to all of us. And therefore, we should ensure that the focus shifts to making humans better and more valuable, rather than using smart technology to actually make the user dumber. By listening to this interview, you will learn three things. Firstly, that we need to be very considerate about the type of solutions we're building and why we're building them in a certain way. Simply realize that humanity's techno-social dilemma is already large enough. Second thing you will learn is that the real value of technology potential is in human augmentation, i.e. becoming better, but only if it's in the light of who we want to be, how we can remain having our choices, and how we can remain being different. And lastly, that we should challenge ourselves whenever we use the word smart in relation to our solutions. How is it smarter? What benefit will it give, and to whom? Too often, it's the user that actually is made dumber. So Brett, thank you for being on this podcast. To get started with it, can you introduce yourself and explain a little bit about what your passions are about technology in general?
Sure. Well, it's a pleasure to be on, so thank you very much for inviting me to have this conversation. Well, I'm the Charles Widger Endowed University Professor in Law, Business, and Economics at Villanova University. And I'm also sort of affiliated with Stanford for their Center for Internet and Society, and as well as the trustee at the Nexus Center for the Internet and Society in Torino at the Politecnico. I teach in the law school, although the courses I teach will be, especially here at Villanova, will be open to students in business and economics and technology and the engineering school as well. For many years, I've taught intellectual property courses, internet law. I also sort of teach privacy as well. My writing and research spans a pretty broad spectrum. So roughly speaking, about a third of what I do focuses on shared infrastructure and the sort of economics and policy and legal issues about infrastructure, interpreted broadly to include things like roads and the electricity grid, but also things like ideas and basic research. Another sort of big, maybe roughly a third of what I do focuses on something called knowledge commons. So communities that collectively produce and share knowledge using sort of Eleanor Ostrom's style approach to studying those communities. And then the other big chunk of what I do is focusing on the relationships between technology and humanity. And yes, that's the latest book that I've published. And I think we're going to be talking about sort of drawn and is sort of in that area. And I'm continuing to research there. I guess in terms of passions, what I'm interesting to talk about passions, you don't often do that, but I'm passionate about knowledge. I guess that's why I'm an academic. I love teaching. I love research. I'm passionate about interdisciplinary research, bridging disciplines, working across disciplines, taking lessons and ideas from different disciplines and exploring them in a systematic and rigorous way. I'm also quite passionate about collaborative research. So much of the work I've done in the last 15 or 20 years has been with others, with other people, both legal academics, but also with economists, with political scientists, with data scientists, with technologists. And so I'm pretty passionate about exploring techno-social systems that we're building and that we live within, sort of exploring our lives, but you know, from an academically rigorous and interdisciplinary perspective.
Cool. That's a lot of stuff. Wow.
I'm passionate about knowledge, I said.
Well, that's an interesting topic in itself. I actually had an interview last week with a company called Unanimous AI, and they have come up with a technology called Swarm AI. And they are actually bringing together groups in real time to share knowledge and to actually then produce better outcomes, better results than AI could produce by itself. So that maybe also kind of is the interesting link to your book, because your book is titled Reengineering Humanity. The reason why I invited you, must be clear then, is I share a passion for technology as well. And the purpose of my podcast is to share knowledge, or to share knowledge, to share ideas and visions about what value we can unlock when we are bringing together people and technology in the right way. Because my belief is, if you augment people, you get better results, like the 1+1=3 type of philosophy. Is that also the idea behind your book?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So the humans have always developed tools and technologies, and they often augment who we are, or enable us to grow, develop, pursue our passions and develop capabilities. And you know, and sometimes they replace old capabilities. So it's sort of like our relationship with the technologies we develop is an interesting one to interrogate and study. And that's sort of, the book is certainly about that, sort of how to think about when technologies we're using do in fact augment and when maybe they don't. So certainly we don't want to assume, because we've got a new novel technology, that it's necessarily going to augment. The difficulty is always sort of evaluating and assessing when it does. Yeah.
What sparked the idea of writing this book? I mean, what issue did you see, or what conclusion did you hope to reveal with it?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you'd sent me by email. You're like, so I thought this was an interesting question. You said, what's the big idea behind your book? Right. And I actually looked at that and I thought about it for a bit. I'm like, huh, I get asked that all the time and I never have a good answer. And it's partly because I don't think there's not really a single big idea. There's a bunch. I guess if I'm pressed, I'd say something like, the big idea is that we're on a slippery slope path toward a world in which more and more of our lives, of who we are and who we can be as individuals and collectively, is managed and governed by supposedly smart techno-social systems. So in a sense, the idea is that the seductive promises of smart digital network tech, you know, the promises of easy, cheap, efficient, convenient, happy lives might be a siren's call for humanity on the whole. Yeah. And so the book sort of rigorously examines, but it also illustrates with a wide array of different examples, seemingly unrelated or disparate examples, I should say, about how we engineer ourselves and also how we're engineered by others. So I suppose I'd throw out like some of the other sort of big ideas include, and here's just a couple that I was thinking of in response to your question, that the real risk of mind control, the idea of a free will wager akin to Pascal's wager about God, reverse Turing test to evaluate when humans are engineered to behave like simple machines, and possibly in terms of a conclusion, the idea that one of the most important constitutional questions in a lowercase c sense for us to be considering in the 21st century is, how are we going to sustain our freedom to be off, to be free from the engineered influence of others? And so I guess I'd have to say that the book is filled with big ideas. Each chapter has at least one. And so that was why it took us 6 years or 5 or 6 years to write the book, is that sort of each chapter was sort of this carefully researched and crafted, you know, I don't want to say a product really, it's just sort of a carefully crafted, researched piece of work, scholarship, that we tried to make accessible to a lay general audience, while at the same time sort of conveying knowledge, conveying big ideas, getting people to think really, really hard about their lives and the sort of the world we're all building together. Like, we're building the world for our children, for future generations, and sometimes we don't stop to think about whether we're happy about the world we're building and why we're building it a certain way as opposed to another way.
I completely agree. But what triggers me at the end is that it took 6 years to write it. And I mean, I'm coming from the technology industry. I've been working in this industry for 26 years. If I look back to 2012, mm-hmm. 6 years ago, and what the world is about today, I mean, it's like a completely different world. So how can you manage to write first of all, that the book took 6 years, likely you have rewritten it 5 times.
Well, we did rewrite it 5 times. That's the thing. That's the thing about writing a book and not writing a book. I'm not going to name it. Like, I was talking to a big fancy sort of fancy guru type person getting a lot of press recently. And I was at a meeting with this person talking with him on the side in the hallway. And he told me that he'd written a book because it was just so important. And he'd written it in 6 or 8 months or something like that. Like, I just felt like compelled to write this book and get it out in 6 or 8 months. So the world could, you know, receive my wisdom. And I couldn't help but think, it was very different from the approach that we took. Our book was very much edited, rewritten multiple times, but each time sort of, you know, evolving in a way that a lot of the core ideas were carefully thought and debated. Both my co-author, by the way, I should have mentioned in the very beginning, is Evan Selinger, who's a philosopher of technology at RIT. But Evan and I ran every chapter by each other multiple times and edited and re-edited and researched continuously. But we also, at least a dozen other people, other reviewers, experts in the various fields we were digging into, because it's a book that's interdisciplinary, were also commenting, you know, reading, commenting, reviewing, critiquing, telling us where we were going wrong, telling us mistakes we were making, making suggestions about things we ought to consider more deeply. And that process is really why I think our book is not about the technology of 2012 or even the technology of 2018. You could take the analysis in our book and you could apply it in 1920, and you could take the analysis in our book and apply it today, and I hope you'll be able to apply it in 50 years in terms of the underlying set of core ideas and the analytical and sort of thought frame, like the knowledge framework that's sort of in the book. Of course, the examples will change. And that is a difficulty. I think you make a good point. Like, so we actually made this example, and if I'm running on too long, just cut me off. I don't mind. We have this example of something like a Fitbit. It's called an activity watch, used in public schools to combat obesity. And we're critical of the way in which this particular surveillance device was introduced into the school system and the purposes and reasons and thoughts that went into it. And I won't sort of preempt, you know, you can read the book if you want the details of it. But what's interesting is we use this as an example. And then we talk in the book a little bit later, a chapter later, we talk about extensions of that example. We basically say, you know, when you use a surveillance technology like a Fitbit in a school system to gather information about the activity levels of students, and everyone gets used to it, right? You sort of engineer a certain kind of normalization, a certain kind of acceptance of the technology. It's not hard to imagine how the use of this kind of technology could creep, like surveillance creep.
Exactly.
Or nudge creep. And if it creeps, we spell out some hypotheticals. Like what if, for example, just pure hypothetical, you know, instead of using activity watch, we start using another kind of sensor that's monitoring other things like emotion, like biometrics or brain activity or emotional activity. And so we use the hypothetical to sort of get the reader to see how the introduction of one technology may lead to other related technologies very easily, right? The first step makes the second and third and fourth steps much easier. But it turns out that by the time the book was come out, some of those second and third steps have already been taken. They're already being proposed. The tech's out there. Like there already are school systems using, you know, introducing technologies that monitor emotional reactions of children so that they can respond more immediately. And so the interesting thing is some of the examples will have to change over time, of course. And some of the things we thought were merely hypothetical are, you know, becoming real.
Yeah. And that's, I think everybody in our private and business life, we haven't got a clue what technologies are already being used to monitor ourselves and to come up with data on this to predict things, to prevent things, or to make things even better. But if you look at the kind of going back to the big idea of your book, or maybe a big
which
conclusion
one? From it. I was joking. I said, which one?
What do you believe is broken? What should we be most concerned about?
You know, it's almost like the thing to be most concerned about is not understanding how complex the actual set of the dilemma is, oversimplifying it so that we can think that there's a quick fix. So it's kind of, I'm going to make an analogy to climate change for a second, because I think this is a useful way to see what, you know, what the danger is, right? So the danger with thinking about climate change is to think that what's causing climate change, the problem is coal. So we just got to replace coal, or it's cars, or if you actually really study climate change and look at or actually pay attention to the scientists and, you know, policymakers and the economists and whoever, everyone who's studying climate change, you'll realize that we have political and economic systems that have been built up over decades to provide us with lots of economic and technological and social benefits cheaply. You know, we've got a carbon fuel-based economy. And when you build up an entire economy and social system sort of reliant on a cheap fuel, it creates a very complex problem. It's not easy to unravel. It's not easy to solve. So understanding the nature of, and there's all kinds of cultural things, even ranging from things like food waste and its contribution to climate change. It's just, it's intense. To diagnose the problem of climate change is not, it's too easy to oversimplify. You've got to deal with it as a complex, sort of wicked problem. It turns out that once you do that, you kind of recognize that the set of solutions are actually also complex. There's a lot of different things we need to be doing collectively at different scales, globally, nationally, locally, as individuals, in our families. Like it's really complex, but there's no escaping that complexity. To oversimplify is to bury your head in the sand and sort of ignore what's actually happening. I think the same exact thing is maybe the big concern that we're kind of raising in our book. Our book's not about predicting the future. It's not saying we're necessarily going to end up as machines or that we are machines today. The book is about trying to help explain so we can even see the nature of the dilemma that we're facing. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with what we call humanity's techno-social dilemma. And so if you think that, when Cambridge Analytica and all of the stories about Cambridge Analytica surfaced, there's a rush to say, like, the problem is, Cambridge Analytica is grabbing data off Facebook. Or even before, like 6 or 8 months ago, the big one was addiction. Technology, big tech is like big tobacco. Uh-huh. They are engineering addiction. And so the thing was, if we could just deal with addiction, deal with the problem, big tech's sort of use of tactics that are like big techs and big tobacco, we kind of strain that analogy and say, that's the problem. The problem is, engineered addiction is a part of the problem, but it's not the whole problem. Even if you didn't have engineered addiction, you'd still have Cambridge Analytica. The problem with thinking about Cambridge Analytica as the nature of the problem is that Cambridge Analytica is one of tens of thousands, probably, of similar companies running on top of and playing on top of and gathering data on top of the Facebook platform. That might lead you to think it's Facebook. But of course, Facebook is just one of multiple platforms, many different platforms operating at the applications layer of the internet that are engaging in a set of practices that enable third parties to gain access, really sort of a lot of access to who we are and what we're doing on its platform. And there's a whole host of other things going on Facebook that don't have anything to do with Cambridge Analytica in terms of how it shapes how we relate to each other and how we exchange information and the conversations we have. So it's not just Cambridge Analytica. That's one of many. It's not just Facebook. It's one of many. And there's a lot of things that aren't even on the internet. And again, go back to the Activity Watch example or the Fitbits in schools. Fitbits in schools, the problem is not that they're internet connected. That's not the issue with there. The issue is the use of a technology in a particular context that is shaping the beliefs and preferences and behaviors of impressionable youth in an environment where they trust their parents and teachers and administrators and others to be sort of watching their backs and helping them develop. And so when children become sort of used to, when you normalize 24/7 bodily surveillance, that's an issue, but it's one that has nothing to do with the internet or Facebook or engineered addiction or those other things. And yet, once you start seeing that there are all of these different kinds of related technologies, you have to say, well, what relates them? What is the commonality? Like, what's going on that connects these various problems that are leading to a world in which what we'll call humanity's techno-social dilemma, we're increasingly building a world that engineers us to be more machine-like and potentially puts our humanity at risk. And there's a couple that turned up. It's the logics. It's the underlying cultural and political and economic logics that are sort of driving progress. And in some ways, progress is great. In like the Steven Pinker, look, everything has gotten better along all variety of different data, metrics that we can look at. And to some degree, in many ways, he has a lot to say about, we are better off today than we have ever been in the past. And yet that doesn't mean it's inevitable that the progress we're, the path we're on, the progress we're making in the last 5 years or last 10 years, or we will make in the next 5, 10, 15, or 20 years is actually going to be net positive. And so you have to be able to step back and think, well, what are those logics driving technological, economic, social progress? What is the nature of the path we're on and why are we on the path we're on? And that's where in the book, we spend quite a bit of time sort of focusing on the logic of efficiency, the logic of maximizing productivity, like optimizing, using technology and social institutions to maximize the use of human labor. So we trace that back to sort of thinking of Frederick Taylor's scientific management of human beings in the workplace, where the idea is like we can get data, we can use data about task performance in the context of a workplace, say a factory. And with that data, we can use management techniques to get as much as possible out of human labor because, that will increase productivity. Once you adopt that logic, that mindset, we can use data to scientifically manage how labor is used to make it more productive, there's really no reason to limit that logic to a factory floor or, an assembly line. You can use the exact same logic to talk about hospitals and schools but also how I exercise. It turns out that when I exercise to stay fit, I'm also laboring. I can be more efficient as a laborer. I can be more productive in my use of time and effort and energy to exercise if I can have it managed, or I can manage it myself, or I can have it managed scientifically through, you know, so you can apply the same logic in so many aspects of our lives that all of a sudden you start seeing, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, like that Taylorist productivity logic seems to be creeping into every aspect of our lives. And hey, that efficiency logic of, you know, let's take certain kinds of signals of value and it'll help us allocate resources so we can become more efficient. You know, those logics creep in and the technology enables. And then we have to think about, is it augmenting? Is it enabling us to become better in light of who we want to be? Or are we basically performing someone else's script?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, one of the introduction quotes in your book says that, well, the book outlines that we should be less scared of robots than becoming more robotic ourselves. And it highlights and convinces that it's more important we embed technologies with human values before we embed us with their own. So what's your point or what's your conclusion there? Because that's what I see also. If I look, for example, back at my previous employer, we created enterprise resource planning type of solutions where a lot of it is about efficiency. And a big part of that efficiency is try to automate as much or as many non-value-adding repetitive tasks out of the process so that it will free people up. But what the whole construct of ERP software was in the past was to make people actually more robotic, because you were actually, as a human, pushing the system forward step by step, screen by screen. And I think it's a good thing that robots take over there, because that's not what humans should be all about. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't know if it's correct. I mean, I'm intrigued by the example. I think our take is certainly not anti-technology or don't ever look for efficiencies. It's more of it's often a difficult question for when you sort of adopt more of a Goldilocks approach and you're looking for something in between. So you certainly want to use technology to improve efficiency in a whole lot of different contexts, right? Efficiency is generally a good thing for human welfare and social welfare. And same thing with productivity. And so it's not that you want to completely abandon it, but you want to know, you want to be able to evaluate when the technology or deployment of technology in various contexts, very contextual, is going to have a direct and possibly lasting impact on what it means to be human or who you are as a human being or certain capabilities that humans have that we collectively or that culturally a particular group actually values. So I'll give you an example of an area where my co-author and I actually disagree a little bit on this. Like, we've had conversations quite a bit, and it's like thinking about smart cars, right? So when I think about smart cars, in other words, self-driving cars or cars that are innate, sort of, if we want to build a smart transportation system, whether it's involving automobiles or it's, you know, public transit, there's a variety of ways to deploy technology to increase human mobility in an intelligent way. But, you know, let's just stick with automobiles for the sake of, just keep it simple. You know, as I see it, and I could be persuaded otherwise, I don't see the particular act of driving, the skills and capabilities that humans perform while driving a car, to be in any way essential to our humanity or important to humanity or sort of necessary in any sense. You know, there are a host of ethical and really big issues we talk about at length in the book that we need to deal with as we if and as we transition to a smart transportation system. And some of those concerns do have to do with our humanity. But it's not that the capability of driving is somehow essential or important. And so if it's more efficient, safe, reliable, better for the environment, and we save tons and tons of lives through avoided accidents, we want to move in the direction of smart transportation systems. On the other hand, there's other, you know, I don't want mobility or navigation in general to be fully automated, right? So it's one thing to say I want a self-driving car. I don't want to have a self-driving body. Like, I don't need myself to be driven. Like, I don't need to get from, I'm at work right now. I'm at Villanova. I live 20 minutes away. I don't need to sort of flip a switch or hit a button or speak a voice command that says, all right, I need to get home. Take me home so that my, you know, mind can be entertained with video or, you know, some virtual reality experience while myself, you know, navigate, you know, smart system takes over and sort of manages my mobility and navigation of the world, whether it's walking, biking, or in a car. Now, that sounds crazy. We're not there yet. Although, as we talk about in the book, there are certainly some technologies developed that are, you know, steps in that direction. And so drawing the line between, like, I think the human capability to have situational awareness, to navigate the world, to actually experience the physical environment that they're in, that seems different to me than car driving skills, right? Driving that particular. Now, some people can disagree. And in the book, we take a pluralist approach. And I don't know that this is the time or, you know, place to sort of go into those details. But Evan and I certainly do not say that we know and we're going to tell you what matters about being human and which capabilities to prioritize. We are quite explicit about the idea that, you know, different communities and cultures will have different priorities and they'll value things differently. And one of the big challenges over time is maintaining plurality so people have the opportunity to be different, to make choices.
Yeah. Well, one of the quotes that I underlined here in the book in the beginning is that was the proposal that the problem isn't the rise of smart machines, but the dumbing down of humanity. And I think the example you just gave is about that. And I think the potential is to use those smart machines in order to smarten up humanity or to augment it, to make
that's the big challenge, I think, is there are some technologies that will absolutely enhance human capabilities and augment what it is that we're capable of doing. And there are others that if we outsource certain capabilities or certain skills or certain tasks on a continuous way throughout our lives, there's a risk of them atrophying. And so the question is where to draw the lines between those kinds of technology and how to evaluate it. So it's true. Like, you know, the book is often, I often say this in talks too, like there is a huge uproar in the tech policy sort of community discussion, and very famous, rich white guys usually in the sort of the AI sort of tech community saying, you know, we're worried about sentient AI, the emergence of sentient AI that will take over the world. And, you know, my response to that is that may be important. That's not what our book's about. That may be important. I worry a little bit that it distracts or sort of, you know, draws attention in one direction and away from more immediate and pressing issues that have to do with, so I'm not interested, as you say, in the emergence of intelligent or overly intelligent machines and how we engineer them. I'm more interested in how we're building, how the technologies we rely on and building are engineering unintelligent humans, or humans that are indistinguishable from or behave like simple machines, right? Yeah. So, and then the question is, well, what does that mean? We use that in the latter part of the book to describe a series of what we call reverse Turing tests or human-focused Turing tests. And the idea is those are both conceptual. They help the reader. They help people see what technology could be doing to us or what I shouldn't even say technology does to us, because technology is not an agent, right? It's always humans who are developing, using, deploying technology. So it's either we're doing to ourselves or developers of technology. There's always other humans involved, but it's, you know, the Turing test ideas, conceptually, it helps you think about what your relationship is to different technologies. But it also, I think, could over time become and can be used as an empirical approach to sort of evaluating the use of different technologies in different contexts. And, you know, we initially start with, so the one thing about the simplified sort of, you know, book blurb kind of idea, like we're interested in unintelligent humans, is it's not just intelligence. We start with intelligence. We talk about certain kinds of intellectual cognitive capabilities that Homo sapiens human beings have and that are arguably at risk of sort of disappearing, atrophying, sort of not being exercised in a world in which we've outsourced our thinking or tasks to technology or technical systems. And so we talk about rationality and irrationality, and we talk a bunch about common sense. Like those are, and we could do a bunch of others that we mention in the chapter that we're hoping other people will explore in further, you know, future work and stuff. But then we also talk about some things that aren't just about sort of how intelligence. We talk about sociality, our ability to relate to each other, right? The ability to read social cues when you're talking or seeing or interacting with someone. You can do that. We have, as human beings, developed a variety of different capabilities that allow us to relate to each other socially. It's sort of a fundamental, I would argue, and at least for me, it's one of the values that I prioritize pretty highly about being human. And yet we also can outsource much of that to technology. There are technologies already being developed and deployed, but there's many on the horizon that can take a whole bunch of data, whether it's, you know, biometric data or otherwise. Those are the inputs that an algorithm can then spit out suggested responses about how you should behave and sort of manage those things on your behalf. And that to us is something we want to pay attention to. And so, you know, the reverse Turing test would get us to think about that.
Yes.
And of course, we go beyond intelligence and sociality, and we talk about free will and some other things. But I'll if you want, we could talk about that more, but I'll just
rambling. No, definitely interesting to hear the various ideas around this. But what triggers me at the end is, if it's about re-engineering humanity, and if we start looking at what the future holds, my perspective at the end is that it's about scaling people. Even if you have the not so intelligent people, we with technology can make them more intelligent. The super intelligent, you can relieve them from doing the mundane work. So from all the conclusions that you, or all the ideas that you got in your book, what advice would you give? What are the top three advice to start doing different? For example, if we start from a software development perspective, what should business software vendors start doing different in terms of thinking, starting points? Any recommendations on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I thought at the end of the book, we've got a litany of sort of suggestions, and they vary. I mean, some of them are policy-oriented and at the very large level, and some of them are more practical and applied and individual. I think one of the things I'd say is that stop and think about what it is you're trying to achieve. So in software development and technological design, there's a bunch of sort of common principles that I think made a lot of sense, and they still make sense sometimes, but they made a lot of sense in the 1990s and 2000s, and they became sort of almost like sort of mantras. And it's, you know, things like we should be using technology, whenever possible, we should reduce transaction costs. Like, let's make things seamless as possible. The user experience should be seamless, quick, and so you think seamless interconnection, seamlessly interoperable. And one of the things we say in the book is, while that sometimes still makes sense, in many ways, maybe it doesn't. Like, sometimes you actually want to engineer friction into your technology. When doing so, provides the human or the user with an opportunity to stop and think, when it actually may empower them to sort of understand what they're doing, and possibly, you know, maybe head in a direction that's other than what the designer is hoping for. So one example we talk a lot about in the book is contracts and electronic contracting and sort of the click I agree interface, the interface through which people create legally binding relationships with software vendors, websites, smart television manufacturers, and increasing with the Internet of Things and deployment of a whole bunch of technologies in a variety of people's lives, there's going to be strong incentives, economic incentives, to have quick click-through style, so you reduce the transaction costs so that it makes it as easy as possible for the consumer to install and get things up and running, and sort of you don't really want them deliberating about anything. But, you know, so one caution I would suggest is, you know, actually we should engineer friction into some of those systems so that people actually, into our contracting and our processes, so that people actually, the most salient and important aspects of the proposed relationships are actually made, transparent, but also substantively relevant to the person who's entering into an agreement. So that's like one of the simple things. Another sort of similar one is reject not everything needs to be interconnected. Interconnection is great in many reasons. It can improve competition. It can enable interoperability. It can have large network effects. So the more the merrier on a particular platform by bringing more people together. And a lot of those things can be great. On the other hand, when we're thinking about supposedly smart tech, it's not clear that my smart toaster actually needs to be smart to add any added functionality that we could possibly genuinely legitimate for a smart toaster. It's not clear that ever needs to speak outside of the house, or in other words, doesn't need to communicate any data to be smart outside of the home. Now, the tendency is let's interconnect it and let's make it internet enabled and let's have it in the cloud and blah, blah, blah. But, people as consumers, but also people developing this technology should stop and think about whether a lot of those things actually make sense. Like you should, as a default, think about whether, collecting and managing data outside the home, if you're doing smart home stuff, is actually justifiable and necessary for the function you're supposedly adding. And we might be able to innovate with this later in the future. That's a self-serving, and that's the thing, is many of these technologies can be developed with sort of a very self-serving motivation, and that's fine. That's just basic, markets and their standard operating procedures. But when you're going into someone's home, or you could be in the hospital, or it could be in the workplace, or it could be somewhere else, we need to start thinking quite carefully about whether we have the trust and whether we've earned the trust of the people with whom we're interacting. And if you want to maintain a trusting relationship with your customers, then maybe you need to sort of treat them as, human beings and sort of engage them in a more meaningful way, even if that means it's a little slower. Maybe you have, it's the higher transaction costs. These are just some of the, examples that, there's plenty of others we can.
At the end, it's about bringing humanity back into the process. And yes. I agree with you, certainly with your first example, that's very recognizable from where I came from, the enterprise resource planning industry, that all of those screens have been designed with the transaction in mind and making things faster and smarter. But at the end, after 20, 25 years, we haven't really gained a lot. And if you would take the opposite approach, you would likely get a lot further, a lot easier. One of the examples that has been a favorite for me for a couple of years now is, for example, why would we have to put in our time and timesheets? Why not have systems just propose it? But no, every time there's a lot of money involved in designing a new, better, smarter, simpler timesheet management screen that everybody hates anyway. And your example, again, around connecting things to the internet and connecting things to mobility. When I bought my new coffee machine recently, an espresso machine, it had the opportunity to create a cup of coffee with my smartphone. Well, who is waiting for that? Because if I want to kind of press the second button for the second cup of coffee for my wife, still have to go to the kitchen to replace the cup. So it doesn't really help. It's just engineered because technology is there.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think so. I have a piece, I think, going to come out in Scientific American soon. I have a couple I've done recently online. I'm working on one now, but it's about, let's just take smart. Whenever you see the word smart, insert supposedly in front of it.
Yeah.
And then think really hard about what people mean by smart. Like, what's smart for cars and smart for toasters means totally different things.
True.
So ask yourself, with every technology that's supposedly smart, who's smarter? How are they smarter? Does the added intelligence actually deliver direct benefits to whom? Who benefits by the additional intelligence? A lot of people, this goes to the augmenting point that you asked about earlier. People presume that smart tech makes the owner, the user, the customer smarter. But I would suggest that the vast majority of the time, the user's made dumber, or at least isn't augmented at all. What's the intelligence, any additional intelligence is largely in some other party. It's either the, you know, the owner, the manufacturer, the manager, the tech, or it's other third parties with whom they're interacting. Now, maybe if customers and, you know, and users are conceptualized as members of a cognitive system that includes a network of different parties, you can kind of say, well, the net system is made more intelligent and you're a part of the system and you benefit. But then the question is, are you actually benefiting? Are you participating in that cognitive system or that intelligence system or intelligence community? Is it a knowledge commons of which you are a member, or are you really, or is the relationship something else? And there's so much taken for granted assumptions because of these very, very strategic and manipulative use of metaphors like smart. I mean, I could give you a couple. You could talk about cloud and replace the word cloud whenever you hear it with someone else's computer. So whenever you say the word cloud, ask yourself, replace it with someone else's computer. And so, you know, I'm cloud services. You mean services on someone else's computer. Or you say, I'm going to store my memories or my photos or my data in the cloud. What you're saying is, I'm going to store my memories or my photos or my data on someone else's computer. As soon as you say that, now there may be efficiencies. Of course, there could be efficiencies for me storing stuff on someone else's computer. That's fine. I'm not saying there aren't some benefits or efficiencies or reasons one might want to do it. But if you say it that way, instead of using this like amorphous word, the cloud, which is just a metaphor to confuse and obscure what's going on, then you start saying, well, who is this someone else? Is it the party I'm interacting with, or is it a third party? What are their security measures? Who else can obtain access to someone else's computer? There's a whole host of other questions that suddenly surface where, and again, this could be both for customers and users and people who are, you know, just lay users of tech, but also who get kind of bamboozled by the word cloud. But it also goes for software developers, because software developers often sort of resort to like cloud services, and the word cloud works a kind of magic, right? It works this kind of magic. We're like, oh, well, yeah, that means there's all these associations and meanings that go along with it. But you got to ask yourself, are they actually legit? Do you trust them? Is there a reason you trust this particular quote unquote cloud provider? And, you know, some of them are. I'm not saying that all companies like, you know, Amazon Cloud Services is probably the most, you know, secure system you're going to rely on. The point is really because you get these metaphorical memes that act as sort of epistemological black boxes. They may make a lot of sense in a particular context, in a particular, you know, setting, but they creep so broadly across so many other things that everybody starts to use them. And then all of a sudden you're like, well, I don't even know if anyone understands what they're talking about anymore.
And that's a big problem that we have today. And I completely agree. I see it every single day that these words are just overhyped. And yeah, I mean, it seems to be part of the whole marketing game. You need to have those words, otherwise you're out of the game and you're not interesting anymore. So I think we are getting close to the hour right now, and that's I want to get to a conclusion. So if you look at the book and the way you've written it, what's next? What's your greatest aspiration that this book will create for the marketplace?
Well, I will tell you the honest truth. I want to say I don't know. My greatest aspiration was, or maybe still is, but it certainly was, I thought the book could be comparable to or have the kind of effect that Rachel Carson's Silent Spring had, or maybe Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, but I think more like Silent Spring, sort of a wake-up call that genuinely is both, you know, a wake-up call, a call to action, a call for resistance, a call for collective governance or cultural change. Sort of the kind of book that if people read it and read it widely and started discussing it and actually engaged with the content of it, we could really question the world we're building for our children and for future generations. And it, so the biggest aspiration I had is that, you know, I don't want royalties. I'd be more than willing to sort of donate any royalties I get from the book to whomever. To charity. It doesn't matter. It's not about money. It's about if the book could be widely read and distributed and talked about. Like, this is just my aspiration. I thought it could sort of have an impact on, like, a genuine impact on the conversations we're having and sort of deepen the conversations in a way that could be meaningful. You know, that hasn't quite happened. And the book is, you know, it's doing perfectly fine. It's an academic book. I'm still waiting for the big set of, like, for reviews to come out and for it to have a broader, like, reach. So I aspire to that. What's next for me is I'm still giving book talks and traveling and trying to spread the word. And I'm writing a lot of shorter pieces, some for the Scientific American, and hopefully for other places, to sort of, you know, build off some of the ideas in the book and sort of explain them with different examples and reach a broader audience. I'm also, you know, working on some grant proposals to do research, empirical research, to study some of the things that we've talked about in the book. I think there's a lot of stuff. The book has plenty of open research problems and questions that could be studied collaboratively, I should say, with different people. And so that's another sort of future plan for me. And then, you know, as I've often done, like, I'm already starting to think about another 5-7 year, like, some other research, another big research idea that relates to all the other ones I mentioned at the very beginning. And that has to do with, how do we know what we want?
Yeah.
How do the political, market, and social systems that we rely on manifest our demands for what we want? So, like, you know, the political system does so through voting, in a sense, the market system through price signals. There's different ways in which we collectively figure out what it is we want, what our values are, what kind of world we want to build. And so I want to sort of think really deeply about that. And then I think the third piece of it is how to evaluate how these systems are working in a world in which techno-social engineering is occurring, where our preferences and beliefs about the very systems themselves is subject to those techno-social engineered influences. And that's a very difficult problem.
I can imagine, yeah, it's a very difficult problem to address and then to create action. Well, thank you very much for your insights. I mean, I wrote down a great number of points that I was inspired by. And I think the advice at the end towards what ISVs could do, or software engineers could do to make better systems, I think will open up a couple of eyes as well. I would recommend everybody in the software industry to read this book, because it opens your eyes about where to take things. But yeah, at the end, it's all about, you know, the things we don't know about yet, and it's iceberg of what's possible these days.
Right.
That's both inspiring and it's also sometimes frightening. But I think re-engineering humanity to see what systems could do to help people not get to dumb them down, but to make them actually smarter, or to combine that together, that's where a lot of the potential lies. So thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure was fully on my side, Brett. And for everybody listening today, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Brett Frischmann, author of the book Reengineering Humanity. The goal of this podcast is to share compelling ideas and showcases to inspire what can be when technology and people blend in the right way. It's my strong belief that too much focus is put on automating people out of a process, in other words, cutting costs, rather than scenarios where the unique strength of people are augmented with technology to change the established rules and to deliver a value that was unimaginable before. So, with this podcast, I want to make a contribution to change this, to create a broader awareness of what can be, to accelerate the adoption by bringing together you, a tribe of like-minded people and organizations, and lastly, to accelerate the initiatives and solutions that could be created because one idea inspires the other. So if you know about stories that are worth sharing, please send me a message. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. If you want to have more information, read my blogs, or obtain information on working with me, just visit me on my website, valueinspiration.com. Thank you for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast or provide me with your feedback. I'll see you shortly in a new episode.